Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
Are you looking to serve God and society? Consider putting your gifts to work as a lawyer. Ave Maria School of Law has been educating faith-filled lawyers for over 20 years. Ave Maria School of Law is committed to training lawyers to use law appropriately around the moral issues of our time. Visit avemarialaw.edu to learn more about integrating your faith with a law degree.
Looking for a way to build daily prayer discipline? Seen the rise in mindfulness meditation, but not sure if it is possible to meditate in a way that's consistent with your Catholic faith? Just looking for a way to breathe new life into your existing prayer routine? No matter what you're looking for, Hollow is here to help. Hollow is a Catholic prayer and meditation app that helps users deepen their relationship with God through audio-guided contemplative prayer sessions. From meditations on the daily gospel, to the rosary, to daily examines, Hollow has something for everyone. Hollow is the number one Catholic app in the U.S. It is free to download and has permanently free content, but you can also check out all of the premium sessions for 30 days, risk-free, by signing up at www.hollow.app/breadbox.
Warning, the Catholic Man Show is about to begin. If you're looking for a dull, feel-good religion, or clap your hands, sit around the campfire, kumbaya, you've come to the wrong place. We are dealing with toxic levels of authentic masculinity. I would say good luck. But luck is for pagans.
Welcome to the Catholic Man Show. We're on the Lord's team, the winning side. So raise your glass. Adam and Ann here sitting in studio. This is a treat of an evening for us. David to my right, Juan on the buttons, Jim hanging out by the door, making sure no one's going to bust in, checking on all of our audio levels. But we have a very special guest that we have been trying to have on for a while, and he has prudently decided to hold out as long as he possibly could. But here he is this evening.
Which shows you the wisdom.
No, it's good to be here.
Dr. Malosh.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Hanging out with us this evening.
But try not to lie on the show.
No, so, okay. So you are the president of the Alcuin Institute here in the Diocese of Tulsa. Mm-hmm. I'm all about what the Alcuin Institute is doing in the diocese. Why don't you give just a little bit of a rundown of, because it's way different than what most dioceses.
Correct. Yeah.
Most dioceses do not have an institute like the Alcuin Institute.
No, but we do. We are seeing kind of an increase, I think, in kind of diocesan level institutes. You know, providing higher forms of education in regards to the faith throughout the country, which is a good sign. Mm-hmm. But the Alcuin Institute is somewhat unique. We were charged principally to provide formation for Catholic leaders throughout the diocese. So working with our catechists, working with our Catholic school teachers, working with the principals, working with civic leaders throughout the diocese, just to provide that kind of intellectual, moral support as they engage in the ministry, mm-hmm. whatever that may be.
We've talked about the Alcuin Institute a lot on the show, especially when we've had recently Brendan Sheard mm-hmm. back on the show. And the Alcuin Institute is what has provided us the opportunity to have guests like Mr. Sheard on the show, because you guys were the ones that brought him in. The diocese did,
correct,
I guess,
yeah.
but through the Institute, the Alcuin Institute.
Yeah. So, he's unique.
Yes.
And that component of what we do is rather unique as well. So, we provide, the kind of formation that you would expect that these kind of intellectual institutes provide. So we provide the, simple explanations of the faith. But we also focus on trying to form the imagination as well as the intellect and the will, which is, unique. A lot of institutes kind of fail. A lot of educational endeavors kind of miss that essential component. How do we form the imagination? And much of that emphasis was really informed by kind of a deep reading of the tradition, looking at how the great schools in the past kind of formed people.
Mm-hmm.
And really emphasizing if we want Christ to be present both in our intellects and our hearts, he must first be present in our imagination. So how do we get Christ in our imaginations in order for us to think deeply, to pray deeply, and to act profoundly in our culture?
And this is a long play game. This
right.
is what I love about the vision of our Bishop David Condorlet. He knows that starting the Alcuin Institute is not going to be something that we're going to see instant results from, quote unquote. This is a long play game. Building up the domestic church, building up the Catholic culture mm-hmm. isn't something that you do overnight. It's not a faucet if you on an off switch. It's something that takes time and really generations, you know.
That's right, yeah. And that's the wisdom of, I agree with our bishop. Mm-hmm. And bring the Alcuin Institute here, kind of giving us that leeway to kind of slowly build up that culture, because it does mm-hmm. take time.
Right. Yeah. Well, one of my favorite things is that you're not just trying to fill the people, you know, the teachers, the catechists with head knowledge, but you're really focusing on human
mm-hmm.
Development, not just intellectual.
Humanities.
Yeah.
Not, John Senior-esque.
I mean, yeah. One of the ways that you guys do that is with an authentic counter with reality. An
Correct.
Encounter with reality, which I think is a funny term, you know, when you first hear it. But then, if you think about it, so much of our lives is encountering something else, you know, in whether it's the digital world or whatever else. It just consumes so much. I know it takes up a lot of my time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do have to, almost on purpose, have these encounters with reality. It kind of shows you how impoverished.
Hey, Juan, will you turn our mics up, please? That would be great.
Yeah, there's a wonderful Canadian philosopher by the name of Taylor, and he emphasized that we are living in a culture which is dominated by artificiality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an impediment. It's an impediment to learning, but it's also an impediment to the appropriation of the faith. And so how can we move beyond that artificiality? And I think we're going to get into this with the Regensburg Lecture
yeah.
later on as well.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay, but before we do that, there are two stories that I have been holding out on this show. When I heard it from you, when you first came in, you were kind enough to have us out to your house, and you were talking about, you know, who is Dr. Milosh, and like, what are you, you know, what's going on, and you were in your vocation story.
Mm.
And the first one I would like you to tell, if possible, is the Carthusian story, if you will.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
How did you end up at a Carthusian is it a monastery?
It is, yeah.
Okay.
Well,
yes.
Yeah, it's interesting. So, you know, I grew up in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Born and raised, and grew up in a good, strong Catholic family. And, you know, as every good young Catholic man, discerned a vocation to religious life and to the priesthood. And so, obviously, I grew up in a parochial school, and we had our parish priest, and I was very blessed and very fortunate to have good, solid priests in this little, small, rural community. And just noticing that example of those secular priests, I thought, okay, you know, that sounds like a good way forward. Maybe I'm called to the secular priesthood, diocesan priesthood. And so I spent some time discerning that vocation and went up to St. Peter Seminary in London, Ontario. I was very fortunate to study under some really good teachers, some good Thomists, but quickly discerned that I wasn't called to diocesan priesthood. So I figured, oh, I must be called to religious. I was a young man at that time and somewhat athletic, enjoyed playing sports.
Mm-hmm.
And so I figured, oh, I could maybe work with the young. And so I kind of looked around to see what religious orders were very prominent working with the youth. And the Salesians, obviously, came to mind. And so I spent time discerning
obviously.
A religious
I mean,
vocation
sure.
to the
yeah.
Salesians of Don right. Bosco up in
yeah.
New York. Great experience there, but discerned quickly as well that I wasn't called to active religious ministry and active religious vocation. So hence I discerned it must be called to contemplative life. And I've always been someone kind of drawn to extremes, and so I figured, oh, well, maybe the Carthusians, you know, and they're a radical order in the tradition. You know, they're basically hermits who live in community, and they only have one house.
Which is funny.
Yeah, it is. And it's funny to experience that as well. And so I wrote them and said, I would love to come and take a look. And they said, sure, come on up. And so there's only one house in Vermont in the mountains. And so spent some time with the Carthusians up there. And it was just a grand experience in many ways. But realized very quickly that I wasn't called to contemplative solitude. I remember just sitting in my cell. They have cells up there, and completely isolated. And you have a little garden that you can go walk around and pace back and forth. But you're just in a cell your entire life. And they have a little trap door that can
lovely
open it up.
Lovely pacing today, brother.
Slide food in and out of the door, and I was in my cell. And I just was irritated beyond belief because of the flapping of hummingbirds and how irritating this noise was. It was just so loud and so bothersome. But I remember the first week I was getting, I had to get out of there. It was just, I had enough. But I spent my whole retreat there, and it was a great experience. But realized quickly that, yeah, no.
Okay, but one of the times that you were there was one of the days of the year that they had a chance to talk. Right?
Correct.
Is that correct?
Correct, yeah. So they have a day in which they're able to converse with their brothers, and they go on this huge, long hike in the mountains. And so I was very fortunate to be able to go on this trip. And so we all jumped in the back of a truck as we're kind of driving up the mountain to go on our hike. And this is the only time that they're able to speak with one another.
Once a year.
And so I was expecting a very profound conversation. What are they going to say to each other?
Stewing over this for 364 days.
That's right. And so I thought this was going to be very, very profound meditations or whatnot coming from the mouth of these very holy, holy men. And I just remembered laughing internally because the first thing that one monk said to the other is, I can't believe brother so-and-so thinks butter is a spice. So even stewing on this whole time, right? They're worried about food, and how terrible their food was, which is very human.
Yeah, it's like, can you just picture thinking about that for a year? I mean, this is the first thing he says.
That's right, yeah.
It's not like, hey, how was the last year for you guys?
Yeah,
you
know,
it's
yeah.
Like, it's like, I can't.
I've been holding on to this for so long.
I have to get this off my chest. He thinks butter is a spice.
So it was a great time. But I quickly discerned at that retreat that, no, I was called to the marriage.
Where do you stand on the butter, spice?
I believe fully that butter is a spice. Yeah.
Do you?
Oh, my goodness. I love butter.
Okay, I did not expect
this
that.
This is something that we'll have to talk about over the break, because I'll be interested on then what the definition of a spice is.
See, I think that butter transcends spiciness. I think it goes beyond. I think to call it a spice is to do an injustice to butter.
Yeah, perhaps I spoke too quickly. Yeah, you may be right. It's more foundational to cooking.
Yes. Yes.
Right? It's the foundation of all good cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, the pig lard was the foundation of all cooking growing.
Now, my wife might be upset about that. Being an Italian, she would argue that olive oil ought to be that foundation. But that's my French-Canadian roots coming out.
Yeah.
Okay, and so when we get back, this bleeds into the other story that I want you to tell, which is your vocation to marriage. What happened? How did you talk to your wife?
I'd love to.
And ask her to marry you.
Excellent.
So we're here with Dr. Milosh from the Alcorn Institute here in the Diocese of Tulsa in eastern Oklahoma. We're on the Lord's team.
The winning side.
So raise your glass.
Welcome back to the Catholic Man Show. I'm David Niles, here with Adam Minahan and Dr. Richard Milosh. Transplant, Broken Arrow, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
From Canada.
Correct.
Does anyone ever... Nobody says that.
No
right?
one.
Yeah, that's dumb.
It's yeah, not
that's
Canuck.
Canuck.
Canuck, yeah, often.
Yeah. What is that?
Someone from Canada.
So one is a Canuck.
Correct, yeah.
But you're not from Canuck.
No. That's right.
An Okie sounds way cooler than that. I got to tell you.
I don't like French.
What about butter? You like butter, though.
I like French cuisine. So I like things about... I like some French things.
This segment...
I don't like the language French.
Oh, no.
this segment is brought to you by the Catholic Woodworker. Go to thecatholicwoodworker.com. Use promo code TCMS for 10% off all purchases. High quality home altars, crucifixes, rosaries. If you're looking for something to get your husband or your wife for Christmas, go to the Catholic Woodworker. Jonathan is a guy who is running this thing, like, on the side. This is his side gig, and he's doing it for the love of spreading the rosary to all people. He has a strong devotion to our mother, and he's a supporter of ours, and hopes that you'd be a supporter of his. So, CatholicWoodworker.com. Now, we did not also... I do want to get into your vocation story, a continuation, but we did not talk about the drink, which is, I think, important to do.
Yeah, and it's unique.
We're men of tradition, and this is a tradition of the show, so we should talk about briefly the drink this evening. The drink we're having is called Midnight Ritual. It's an American malt whiskey, which is interesting that we've been on an American whiskey kick.
Yeah.
Over the last few episodes. It's 44.5% alcohol ABV, but it is a combination. So it's by Founders Distillery, which Foundry Distilling, which is the guy who started Templeton Rye, if you are familiar with that whiskey. But he is collaborating with Boulevard Brewing Company. Oh. So Boulevard Brewing sends up their mash up to Foundry, and they use that mash to distill whiskey. And so this is a very interesting because you can definitely taste the wheat. It's almost like a wheated whiskey.
You have to say it right.
Wheated whiskey.
Wheated.
I mean, you can taste the. It's very interesting because it's a very. It's like a hybrid of. You can almost have you have a little bit of that Boulevard wheat taste. Mm-hmm. Do you taste a little bit of that?
Yeah, doctor? I do. Yeah, and it's very smooth.
Mm-hmm. It is. It is very.
Yeah, there's no bite at all.
Easy drinking.
Yeah, and that's kind of surprising because Templeton Rye sometimes as a rye whiskey, you have a little bit of more of a bite. So,
but this isn't a rye.
No, it's not. But you know, the founder started Templeton Rye, so you kind of would
that would
envision.
Be his genre,
right? But it's very good. It's very affordable. I think it's about $40 for a bottle. It's not. So it's not going to break the bank.
How old is it? Is there an age statement?
There is not an age statement, I don't believe. But it's aged 24 months. It's aged 2 years in the barrels that they put in Foundry.
Okay.
It's
interesting that we have this today because I had never heard of anybody doing this, making whiskey this way, until like 2 weeks ago. My brother-in-law brought me one. It was a whiskey from Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're taking their Belgium wheat beer that they make and doing this exact same thing.
Yeah, they're getting very experimental with this whiskey. But it's made out of in Iowa, so all of our Iowa listeners, shout out to you guys. You can go pick up Midnight Ritual by Foundry. It's collaboration with Foundry and Boulevard Wheat.
My grandma was from Iowa.
Nice.
Morning Sun, Iowa. Doesn't that sound like a nice place?
Sounds pleasant.
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
Very small town.
Also, let's get into this really quick before we get into his vocation story. Sorry, guys. We have a lot to cover in a short amount of time. But Dr. Christine Myers, who was on our show not too long ago talking about the feminine genius, gifted us and gifted you guys with this beautiful painting. Recently, we had a call to action to all men. The Diocese of Tulsa asked us to ask men to get up in the middle of the night to pray for the success of the pro-life movement, specifically for during the 40 Days for Life. Because of the COVID virus and everything, we weren't able to have a perpetual prayer throughout the whole 40 Days for Life at the location here in the diocese. So we asked you men to join us in prayer in the midnight hours, and you guys stepped up. I think we only missed somewhere between 7 and 9 hours, if I'm correct in that, because you guys stepped up, and so I'm very grateful. We had guys even from Scotland stepping up for us, which was very nice, very kind. And I mean, we had men from the council, Council of Man, patreon.com/thecatholicmanshow, who stepped up. And so anyway,
become a Patreon member.
We're very grateful. talk about, and I even had a couple guys reach out to me and said that they woke up their sons to join them in prayer in a midnight hour, which I think is just beautiful. Mm-hmm. For talk about setting the example as a dad of the importance of prayer, especially when it comes to defending the life of the innocent. That is beautiful. It's just beautiful.
Yeah, so, that's great.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you to Dr. Myers for getting us that picture. That was awfully kind.
Thank you.
We'll be sharing that with all you guys. So, Dr. Malash, we're going to get into a topic very soon, but I want to ask, so you discerned out of religious life. You decided, no, religious life is not for me. I'm obviously called for marriage.
Was the Carthusians the last place you went?
Yes.
You said, okay.
You
exhausted everything.
You even went to Clear Creek, didn't you?
No, not to discern.
Okay, you didn't.
No.
But surely you went to the Benedictines somewhere.
I didn't, no.
What?
Well, I know, it's surprising. Because I have such a love for the Benedictines.
Yeah.
But no, I did not. It's probably very providential that I didn't.
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah.
So you decide I'm called to the married life.
Correct, yeah.
Talk us through calling what would be your wife at that point.
The next series of moves
that you made. Because it is fascinating.
I fear that you gentlemen are trying to get me in trouble.
No.
I would never do that.
No.
So I'm in the monastery at the Charter House in Vermont, the Carthusians, and obviously discerning and realizing that I must be called to the married life. I've kind of canceled out all other religious kind of vocations, secular priesthood, active religious, contemplative religious, must be called to the married life. And so at that moment, towards the end of my retreat, I began to consider, all right, Lord, if I'm called to the married life, whom shall I marry?
Who's the most beautiful woman I know?
That's right. And yeah. As I was pondering this, I knew this beautiful and charming and sweet and intelligent and just this wonderful young lady that I went to high school with.
Opposites attract, you know.
Right. Well said, David. Thank you. Very much so. Very much so. And we are opposites in many, 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 many ways. And so I figured I must be called to marry this woman who is subsequently my bride. And
you know what? This is great because I think every man can relate to this feeling. Like you think they think of the most beautiful woman that they know, and it's like, I must be called to marry her.
But in my case, it was true.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, then they realize maybe for most of those men, I think they later realize she's not the most beautiful woman that I know, because most of the time it doesn't work out. But in your case,
okay,
carry on.
So yeah, so at that point, we maintained a friendship. She was a classmate with my younger sister, and so when I would go back, we would see each other on occasion and whatnot. And so I figured I must be called to marry her through my discernment. And so when I got out of the monastery, the first thing I did, I got onto a bus and went back up into my native homeland, Canada, and found a payphone and called her. I think it was a payphone. Maybe I emailed her. Anyways, I got in contact with her. And she was over in Rome at this time teaching ESL to Italians. And so I emailed her, phoned her, and said, I think God is calling me to marry you. And of course, what is she to do? But she gets on the next plane and comes back home, and we start courting and subsequently got married. So now she tells a much different story.
But this one's, we don't let truth get in the way of a good story.
That's right. That's correct.
Right. Another child.
Correct. Yeah. So we had our seventh child. So we have two girls and four boys. So
congratulations. Yeah.
That's only six, just so
Excuse
you know.
Excuse me. Five boys, two girls. Thank you. Yeah. Quick with the math. Yeah, good.
I've got the single digits down pretty well.
So you said, Noah Constantine.
Congratulations. Congratulations.
It's awesome.
There's wonderful rationale why God gives young children to younger couples. I'm realizing that now. I mean, I used to be able to go on 6 hours sleep. No problem. Mm-hmm. 5-10 years ago. Now it's difficult.
Yeah.
It's still difficult for me.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is still difficult. I do it and it is difficult now.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. It gets more difficult.
And there's a lot of self-loathing at the beginning of the day when one wakes up after 5 hours.
So we're going to talk about the incarnation this evening. I think that it's apropos to do so, being we're entering into the season of Advent after Christ the King Sunday. And why, you know, that we're going to talk about the incarnation, why the Lord came at the time that he did. You know, a lot of times I think I've heard from other atheists or agnostics saying, like, well, if God could just come anytime, why would he come at the time that he did? Why not now when there's so many more people? And,
or did he not love everyone who came before him?
Right. You know? I mean, there's a lot of questions that happen with the series of when did the incarnation happen. So what is the importance of that? Why did he come? What was happening during that time? And how we can better prepare for Advent, I think, would be a good way to sum up at the very end.
Excellent.
All right, we'll be right back. We're on the Lord's team.
The winning side.
So raise your glass. Welcome back to the Catholic Man Show, here with Dr. Malosh, president of the Alcuin Institute. Check out the Alcuin Institute. You're in the process of about to start a podcast. If you,
We're contemplating getting into that.
Thinking about it. And you have a blog that you go and...
Very contemplative institute.
Instagram. You can go to alcuininstitute.org and check out what they are doing. If you're not in the Tulsa Diocese, you will still receive benefit from doing so. So alcuininstitute.org.
I just got to tell you this. One beef I have with the Alcuin Institute.
Yeah, sure.
Last year, fake Christmas tree in the lobby there. I know it's like other people. It's not just the Alcuin Institute building, right? But there was a fake Christmas tree, and that's just, I don't know. It doesn't jive.
It's unfitting.
It's unfitting. See, I want you to do your best. Have no fake Christmas tree this year. I know it's like that might be an uphill battle for you.
If you hew a tree and bring it in, they'll have to use it.
All right, it's on you, Dave. Way to go.
Any tree?
Okay, so we're talking about the incarnation. We're going to talk about, like, the thing that matters the most. The incarnation, our Lord.
What Thomas calls the most marvelous.
The most marvelous.
Yeah, because the main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the incarnation.
Yeah.
The Lord coming down and becoming man. So maybe give a little bit of background into why the Lord came. So there's like three things that are happening in this time that's converging all at once. That is going on in the political, social, economic the academic, all coming in together and colliding right when our Lord came. So maybe give us a background in this.
Yeah. Now, I'm not a historian by any means, so I'm a systematic theologian. So, you know, I like to look at the larger kind of sapiential picture as opposed to the historical picture.
Now, I don't know what that means, sapiential.
The wisdom, the big picture.
Okay.
Looking at causes as opposed to effects.
We'll recapitulate this later and just edit that out.
That's fine.
Okay.
Go ahead. And what you have then...
I know what recapitulate means.
What you have is you have, of course, the Jewish faith. Mm-hmm. Right? So this rich biblical faith. In addition to, obviously, you know, supernatural faith of the Jewish people, but also their moral codes, so rightful living as well, in addition to. But then also you have the background of a Hellenic worldview, Hellenic philosophy, Greek philosophy. We can get into that, specifically Aristotelian philosophy and the importance of that in regards to the incarnation. And politically, you have the Roman Pax, the Roman peace, the Roman order, both culturally and civically. And I think it's these three that come together that is most fitting for the incarnation, which allows for the truth of the life and the mission of Christ to take root and to flourish.
Okay, so maybe we'll start with the philosophy aspect, because when Juan brought this subject up, he's really stepping up. Shout out to Juan. Thank you, Juan. When he brought this up and he was talking about how the Greek philosophy was penetrating into the social dynamic, I guess, of the world. I was a little confused by that because I had thought that that wasn't, especially the Aristotelian philosophy, wasn't well received during that time, because I thought that's what, you know, Aquinas was merging this pagan idea of Aristotelian thought and drawing from him and bringing it into the church to combine, to take what was good and make it part of the truth. You know, it was the truth, so he brought it in. So when that was said, I was a little confused by that because I thought that that wasn't part of up until like I thought that's what made Aquinas kind of like what he did somewhat special.
Yeah, that's fake news. Right.
That's good to know. Yeah. I'm uneducated.
That's a false narrative, and it's a very popular false narrative.
Okay.
And this is, you know, Juan once again kind of leading us off here, pointing to the Regensburg lecture.
Yeah, Juan's going to want to get paid soon. It's ridiculous.
I mean, it's great insight. Insofar as it is the Regensburg lecture and Pope Benedict's kind of articulation of the de-Hellenization of Christianity, and he really brilliantly points to that as the root cause of all of our cultural ills, all of them, which is a kind of really profound statement. I think it's a truthful statement. But basically what we have adopted is this rejection of Hellenic Greek thought and these Aristotelian principles. Mm-hmm. And so when we look back in history, we're seeing things through this false narrative, this anti-Hellenic bias that is perverting our understanding of what the incarnation was truly about. So, yeah, it's not surprising when you think about it. Oh, I didn't think Greek philosophy and Greek thinking and the Greek worldview has anything to do with Christianity. But according to Benedict, it has everything to do with Christianity.
So it didn't have anything to do with Judaism, but it did have everything to do with Christianity, which is kind of you could really draw an uninterrupted line between Judaism and Christianity. It's, you know, we could talk about the Jewish faith and the Christian faith, or we could just simply say the faith. There's pre-Christian revelation and post-Christian revelation, you know. So it's just interesting that this was almost like an incarnation of thought that came and accompanied Christ's incarnation into the world.
Yeah, it's almost a precursor. Right,
It was a John the Baptist,
a necessary foundation for the message of Jesus Christ. So you had the biblical faith, you had the moral principles that were motivating Jewish living, but then you had this the influence of Greek thinking and how that allowed Christianity to flourish. Because all of a sudden, Christianity is not simply blind faith, but rather we can use our native faculties of knowing to understand more profoundly not only the Jewish faith, but also the revelation, the fullness of revelation that Jesus Christ provided.
So what is it about the Greek culture that allowed them to flourish so well in this? I mean, can you just think better on an island? Or, like, what made them good at... Was there one thing that you're aware of that help them cultivate the philosophical aspect?
Well, the church points to three principles, really, of Hellenic thought. Now, this is not clear in the Regensburg lecture, but it can be teased out in subsequent magisterial teachings. But basically, you have three fundamental principles that the church from this Hellenic tradition adopts wholesale and builds upon. So those are a really robust realism, that the real is really real, right?
Hashtag Aquin Institute.
Exactly.
Yes.
And John Senior and many other profound thinkers. Everything that we say is nothing new, right? This is the tradition. And so that's the first foundation, right? It's that contrary to idealism, where things originate in the mind, no, things originate because they are. Being is the font of all knowledge and understanding. So that's a foundational principle of all Aristotelian Greek thinking. In addition to that, they looked upon the human person and realized that the human person had these passive capacities, these pre-rational capacities to receive being, i.e. the senses and the imagination. So we have these passive components by which we can actually receive that which is real. In addition to that, the third principle of this kind of Greek philosophical tradition is that we can receive those in our senses through this kind of passive openness to being. But in addition to that, we have another native faculty, i.e. our intellects, who can abstract the contingent, the finite, from the universal, and can contemplate truth in and of itself. So we have a passive and an active capacity to receive being. So these three Aristotelian or Greek or Hellenic philosophical foundations then are eventually adopted by St. Thomas and in the tradition at large and become the foundation for our understanding of grace, of revelation, and whatnot.
And so when this was all happening, like, you know, around, 3 AD, BC, whenever that, right before Christ came, was this thought understood? Like, was this a norm in society? Like, was this being proposed by scholars at that time, or how did that...
It was foundational. So
it was within the culture of the society.
Correct. Like, you read Paul, right, who is a very learned Jewish scholar.
I have heard of him.
And in addition to that, you know, grew up and was schooled in Hellenic thought. And that is very evident in his teachings and his writings. Anyone who was educated were influenced and informed by these Aristotelian principles, these Greek principles, not solely Aristotelian, but right, these Greek foundations.
Okay, so you keep mentioning this address. Mm-hmm. What? Briefly tell us, what is the Regensburg.
Yeah, the Regensburg lecture was...
Regensburg.
Correct, yeah. Was an address given by Benedict the 16th, 2006. It was given at his alma mater, the University of Regensburg. Mm-hmm. So he was going back. He was invited back to give this academic talk. They had something called the Academic Days, in which all the schools would come together and you would have various scholars actually have a dialogue and present it to the entire population of the universities, both professors and students. And he gave this talk at that time, and he addresses this fundamental problem, namely the de-Hellenization of Christianity. And he really called for the disclosure of this truncating of reason and a call to rediscover the breadth of human reason.
All right. Nice. So we got one leg of the tripod. We'll get the other two on the other side of the break. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Catholic Man Show. I'm David Niles, here with Adam Minahan. I'm Dr. Milosh. We also have Juan Posada and Jim Spencer in the house. Thanks, guys. All right, we're talking about Jesus, a guy you may have heard of.
We try to talk about him every episode.
And his birthday. And why his birthday was on that day.
Yes. And so we've discussed the Greek capacity, kind of the Jewish capacity, and we want to discuss the Roman capacity.
Yeah, so that's the third leg.
The third leg.
Yeah, sure. Which is really quite interesting. So you had the flourishing of the greatest kind of civic, national, cultural entity, right? The Roman Republic, which was known for order. Right? This is their hallmark of their dynasty, and it would seem then, in regards to the incarnation, that it is that order, that pax, that peace, which allowed for the ultimate good of Christianity, which is using our intellects via these native powers to investigate and to explore divine revelation, Jesus Christ. And so it's almost like the Roman order, the Roman peace, is the preamble, which allows for the Jewish faith and the Christian, the Jewish faith and the Greek philosophy to meet And that great merger between those two fonts of knowledge, divine revelation and native human intellect.
Because the Romans would let you retain your religion, for the most part, when they conquered you.
Correct,
which is kind of a unique characteristic among conquerors.
That's right, yeah. But specifically, it's that peace, right? And a lot of times we think, well, what constitutes peace? Oftentimes we think of, you know, peace as something internal, which it is. But ultimately, peace is a result of order. Mm-hmm. And understanding that order and living in accordance with that order. And when there is that order, there is peace. We know this as husbands and fathers, right? When we have peace in the household, what meaning is that we have actual order in the house. Mm-hmm. You have the father, you have the mother, you have the children, obedience to the parents. And when that is in play, you have peace. Now, it may be rare, but when it does happen,
it's beautiful.
It's gorgeous.
It is just a slice of heaven.
It's like a great 10 minutes.
But when you do have that...
in every, like, 3 years, it's a great 10 minutes. Yeah.
But when you have that order, you are now free. Only then are you able to contemplate. You're able to use your intellect to explore what has been divinely revealed. Mm-hmm. And that's just true both extrinsically but also intrinsically. Right? When there's order in the human person, only then can you have contemplation.
Yeah, because contemplation takes more than just, you know, structure. It has to be rightly structured so that who man is, his outward life is in accord with his inward. You know, like, mm-hmm. if man is living outwardly in a way that is not in accord with who he is really, then that contemplation will be, it'll be dysfunctional.
And almost impossible.
Yeah.
Especially if you're living a morally vicious life. Mm-hmm. Right? If your libido in your belly is constantly rebelling against your intellect, it's impossible to think.
Right. Even if you're raised and firmly believe that the life you live is solidly moral. I mean, a person, you know, it's not that, oh, well, your conscience is getting in the way of your contemplation. That's not it. You could believe very firmly that I live the right way and mm-hmm. that my life is good. But that doesn't mean that it is. And that still would prevent, because for exactly what you said, you would be either ruled by your appetites mm-hmm. or, you know, if you're not living in accordance with reality, then something else is going to be governing you, mm-hmm. which would there thwart that capability, that freedom to contemplate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So again, you have these three that are coming together, which is the perfect trifecta, right? Mm-hmm. Which allows the Christian faith to flourish.
So one thing that I've heard is an argument or something levied against the incarnation happening at the time that it did is that, well, what about all the people before Christ? You know, did God just not love them or something? You know, that they didn't get to be saved, you know, whatever. And I never really knew what to say. It's like, well, I don't know. Like, I just don't know. You know, ask God. But
ask God.
One thing that I have been told is that actually immediately after the incarnation, there is an explosion in population worldwide. And so that he actually came, that the population after the incarnation versus the population mm-hmm. beforehand is drastically different. And so he did come.
I didn't know that.
At a time when, you know, God is not leaving that many people pre-incarnation. I mean, you know, a lot of people still, but not on a relative basis.
Yeah, I mean, I think kind of the artistic tradition can help us understand this a bit. For example, if you turn to Dante in his Inferno.
Why is he not canonized?
I think Harrison actually did. Harrison Garlick just...
He did.
Didn't he tweet that?
He tweeted that today. And
is that right?
First of all, I want to say that I do not think that Greece is an island, but Greece has a lot of islands on it, okay? He's giving me flack on Facebook.
Okay, you did say that.
I said that, but I know it's not an island. Okay.
That's funny.
It's a good clarification.
Anyway, Harrison's
also an underrated person on Twitter. You can follow him.
Go follow Harrison Garlick on Twitter and then try to convince him that Greece does have islands. He needs to know this.
Okay.
And so what Dante interestingly does is, you know, if you read the Inferno, he has Aristotle, he's in hell, but he's in the lowest rung of hell, and he's enjoying a natural beatitude.
In hell?
In hell.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah. It's almost the antechamber to hell. And so he's enjoying this great human flourishing.
Almost like a limbo?
Yeah, kind of, sort of.
Okay.
The point being is that the incarnation, in regards to, you know, the both the passive and the active that we're talking about, right? The passive reception, the capacity to receive being, and then the active capacity of our intellect to actually engage reality and to divide and to separate and to contemplate truth in and of itself. The incarnation reveals the glory and the dignity of those capacities. And so even subsequently, the incarnation is revelatory to those who've come before, because it reveals the greatness of a natural or native humanity, even post-fall.
Is it possible that in the story, Aristotle is in the bosom of Abraham? Because the bosom of Abraham, it's not heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Are you getting into speculative theology with a systematic theologian?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
This is like not his. Okay, no. So let's go back. So I'm pulling us
back. I'll save you.
Let me call you your savior. Yeah, let's pull us back. So our Lord is coming at this time. Advent is now approaching. What are some good ways? Like, what would you do as a family man to reflect upon these times in, you know, as Advent approaches, on the incarnation?
Yeah, I mean, specifically in reference to what we've been discussing, right? So we have the Jewish faith, you know, and that biblical faith, and we have our reason. So there is, in a sense, and then we have the order, the Roman peace. And if it's true that the incarnation happened at that time, and that is the most fertile soil in which the incarnation can take root in the flourish, I think it's appropriate to reflect upon, well, what does that mean for the individual soul, right? I mean, is the soul been properly tilled through both, you know, the practice of these natural virtues, this biblical faith, also having the proper ordering, also having this foundation of philosophical thought, this philosophical speculation, this philosophical questioning? Have we cultivated both the philosophical and the moral and the order, the natural civic order, which will allow the truths of the gospel, the incarnation, to occur in our own being? I think that's a good question.
It's a great question. Mm. What is the answer?
Well, what can we do? Have we?
Thank you for asking the question that I was supposed to ask you, but you articulated it better. Now, take that question. And I'll regurgitate
That's a good trick to ask me a better version of the question I asked you. I don't know. I asked you first.
Well, these are things that we can do, right? So we can cultivate order, right? Both by cultivating the moral virtues in the person, but also having proper order in our families.
Yeah. Okay. So ordering what? Our families.
Families.
Starts with the husband.
Head of house. Correct.
Yes.
Yeah. And then having that proper ordering between the spouses and the children, proper ordering within the larger parish community, also very important. This all facilitates contemplation, which is the beatitude, human happiness. So making that sure that foundation is in place, because you cannot contemplate without having that peace. So trying to cultivate that peace both by cultivating moral virtue and then also having peace within the household, something that within our purview that we can do.
So I'm hearing you say examination of conscience, confession, and
ordering your home.
Sure. Yeah. Those are important steps.
Yeah.
But then again, to not regulate the faith to blind faith, begin to cultivate the life of the mind to exercise philosophical reasoning
yes.
in exploring the rich and glorious tradition of the Catholic faith.
Which is very important. Dr. Mullish, we'll continue just a little bit more on the other side. This is the last segment, but you can check us out on YouTube for the extended version of this show.
No joke.
I'm very grateful for your time and your wisdom. You can go to thealquininstitute.org for more information on what Dr. Mullish is doing. Thank you so much for hanging out with us this
evening.
It's
been a lot of fun.
We're on the Lord's team.
The winning side.
So raise your glass.
And cheers to Jesus.
Yes. So, because I really did want to actually bring in on the understanding of, like, the virtue of studiousness mm-hmm. and making sure to push ourselves intellectually. I think it's very hard for an everyday guy who is going through the grind of work, yeah. coming home, spending time with your wife and your children, getting them down for bed, you know, spending time with your wife alone, and then, like, you know, when am I supposed to have this time to read Aristotle or have the mental bandwidth, the mental capacity to even dive into the intellectual side of our faith and reality, I guess. Yeah. Like, it's very hard. Like, I know I struggle with it, and I want it. You know, I yearn for it, but I still struggle with it because by the time I have the time, I'm drained.
There's a wonderful quote by Frank Sheed.
Oh yeah, Theology of Sanity.
Yeah, I mean every other sentence is a quotable line, but he says that thinking is difficult and we are lazy. And that kind of summarizes it.
Yeah.
I mean, if we prioritize...
On this show, we just say, words are hard.
That is actually a quote that we have. And we may end up trademarking that.
Words are hard. Words are hard.
Yeah, they are. But thinking is even harder than words.
Do you think in other things? Can a man who has received no language think? I mean, like, he can still...
I think so.
Be hard.
Well, I mean, even look at infused wisdom.
You couldn't. It seems like you'd have fewer thoughts anyway.
So, well, you could say you can have a few infused wisdom.
Sure.
Which
also, I'm just assuming a man who has received no language also hasn't been baptized. Just so you know,
mm-hmm.
he could still have infused wisdom, but
yeah. But I mean, so the phantasms are informed by divine revelation itself, as opposed to intellectual rigor.
Okay, so would you suggest as a, you know, you've been a professor for a long time, you get to have the luxury of pushing your intellect on a day-to-day basis insofar as having intellectual conversations, being able to read, some of the great minds of the church. Mm-hmm. A lot of the guys out there, including myself, don't have that luxury. I'm trying to convince guy X over here that that reality is reality, much less the idea of concepts of
modern example is that recently on Twitter is this big thing about how some dude who dresses in, I don't remember who the guy was, but he wears dresses and how masculine he is, and
he's like Vanity Fair.
Yeah, I think so.
Yes, yeah, yeah, that's exactly what I'm referring to. And so the thing is that these people who think that a man wearing a dress is masculine they refuse to say what is a man and what is a woman because they don't know. They can't tell you. They're so removed from me. I mean, it's like this is – I don't know what is more basic than the understanding of this is a man,
mm-hmm.
this is a woman,
yeah.
you know.
This is something that people like us, people that live in the secular world that don't have this opportunity to
I mean,
that we combat every day. So, like, we're starting in, like, some
and the temptation, you walk into a, you the temptation walk into, and maybe it's the right thing to do, is just to write them off and say, like, mm-hmm. You're hopeless. Like, I don't know.
You know, you walk into a kindergarten classroom, and every single one of them can say which one's a boy and which one's a girl. Yet, I'm walking into work at times and having...
But Elijah Wood can't... He doesn't know the difference.
I don't... You know? And so, like, what advice do you have for the men out there who don't have that luxury, but still want to, but... Man, it's just like there's this heavy burden about all this other stuff that they have on their shoulders. Mm-hmm. How do we do that? Like,
yeah, no, it's a huge problem. And again, it comes down to Taylor, right? The artificiality, kind of bring it back to where we started. Mm-hmm. And if we need to, I think we need to engage with the real. Yes. We need to inform the imaginations.
Are you saying to break our cell phones? Is that what you're saying?
Smash our televisions?
Flush them. But in many ways, because we haven't experienced the real...
Right.
Cell phone would never flush. I'll tell you, they're too big.
We can never think, right? We can never think properly because we don't have the phantasms to draw upon. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, for entire generations now who have been... I don't want to say corrupted, but have been prevented from actually experiencing real things, whether that is real relationships, real words, real texts, real images of what it means to be an authentic male and an authentic female.
Even real conversations.
Real conversations. Yeah, to have this conversation, I would imagine, with, you know, a millennial is very difficult to do. Because they even know how to do it.
Adam and
I really do think this is what's so attractive, and this is one of the reasons why I said, all right, finally I'll come on the show, right? Because in many ways, it's an artificiality, what we're doing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. For our wonderful viewers out there, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But they don't know what it looks like to sit down and have a drink and have a pipe and actually engage in a conversation. And so this platform, I think, is a great good because it's providing an image for them what an authentic conversation really should look like.
I just want you to know that Adam and I are millennials.
I know.
Are we? Are we technically?
We are technically millennials.
Mm, that's unfortunate.
Very much so. It's all right.
But also, we are the, like, the youngest... No, the... We're the oldest generation. We're like the first generation that grew up with a cell phone in their hand. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I remember I got my first cell phone at 16, but this is like it was a defining moment. Mm-hmm. The pre-mobile phone generations and the post-mobile phone, because, you know, here we are talking about this encounter with the real. Mm-hmm. And so, like, that was a... And still to this day, it's technology is this... is the thing that draws us mm-hmm. away. It's the thing that deprives us of silence. It's the thing that brings us into a world that isn't real. Mm-hmm. And right. We spend so much time with it.
Right.
I mean, I try my best, but I'm on my phone a lot. You know, it's addictive. Mm-hmm. And I'm addicted to it. I mean, that's just the honest truth. I don't want to be, but the alternatives of not having a smartphone are very severe. I mean, all of a sudden, no texting. I mean, no. That's, like it or not, that is the way the world is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and you can't just run and hide
from it
because. Okay. So anyway,
yeah.
So a little bit of a sidebar, but not quite.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I agree. No, I agree. So there's one more thing that I did want to bring up, though, insofar as the pragmatic way of worship, because we talked about the intellectual, we talked about we talked about the Jewish tradition and the importance of worship, but how that plays a role into the domestic church, like the import, like I think that sometimes in this conversation we kind of downplayed the worship aspect, but there is that is an important factor in worship and.
Foundational.
It's foundational. It absolutely is. And so, and as fathers, it is imperative for us to make sure that our children understand what worship is, not only what worship is, but the importance of it and how the virtue of decorum even plays into worship.
Sure.
I will give you a quick example of actually your family, which you you probably didn't even know this, but when you guys came, or you weren't prepared that I was going to say this, but when we had the rosary run this year for the St. Michael Catholic Radio, we had the rosary at the beginning of right before Mass started, before the event started. We had the rosary that we all prayed together, and I looked over and I saw you and your children kneeling praying the rosary. Now, this was a regular gathering outdoors, you know, and there was a lot of people praying the rosary. Most of them were seated, a couple of them were standing, but you guys were kneeling.
Mm-hmm.
It's the importance of the and I'm assuming that they got that understanding that you were the one that was kneeling first, so I will do what Dad's doing to pray. So, like, the importance of decorum, even in our body language and stuff, while worshiping, is very important to teach our children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, matter matters. And so, yeah,
I just had a 3-minute spiel of talking about this, and he goes, matter matter. He said two that. Words, matter matters. I'm sorry again. I'm not articulate
enough.
No, it's true.
And it's almost the same word twice.
Yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. Man, I'm. Yeah. Sorry, I apologize. But no, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, yeah, you're absolutely right that, you know, because of the composition of the human person, that in regards to worship, you know, we fall into two extremes, right? Either we have this super spiritual understanding and or a very materialistic understanding of the human person. And, of course, both extremes are erroneous. But the matter, our bodies, can inform the higher. So even if you're not intellectually engaged in the mysteries of the rosary, for example, when you're praying, your body can inform your intellect that I should be paying attention. Why? Because I'm in pain. I'm kneeling. I'm yeah. doing something that's uncomfortable. Right. And this reminds the intellect, oh, yeah, that's right. I'm in an act of devotion right now. And yeah.
Right, that's
and
why we fold our hands while we
exactly.
pray.
Yeah. Yeah, so all these little kind of cues.
That's actually why I do this
the
now.
Spirit.
Because this is much more uncomfortable than this.
Mm-hmm.
And this brings me back to attention of, oh, yes, I'm supposed to be praying.
Exactly.
This is much more comfortable than this.
You think so?
Yes.
Yeah.
I got that actually from Father John Hollowell. He's the one that told me. Like,
I find
he made a very distinct decision to go this route, even when he's praying in Holy Mass, wherever he's praying, you will not catch him doing this. He does this.
I find them equal in comfort. However, I realized when I waffle style my hands,
mm-hmm.
I have a tendency not to have my palms together. So just I pray like this instead of like this. And I saw a picture of me doing that once, and I realized it does not look as reverent. And so when I pray by myself, I'll still do this just because, I don't know, I find it more natural. But when I pray in front of my children, I do this just because I know I saw a picture, and I said, that looks more reverent than that one. That's mm-hmm. the one I'll do in front of my kids.
Yeah. Wonderful.
Sorry. Interrupted. I don't remember what you were saying, but I know
I'm sure
it was better
very
than
important.
It was better than what I was saying. That's all I know.
I think.
What was it? Did you have?
I was just complimenting him on kneeling while praying.
Yeah, and it reminds me actually of Brandon Sheard when he was just here. We were talking about slaughtering a sheep,
mm-hmm.
and I'm becoming more and more convinced of something that I told him is that I think that God created the sheep just like simply for to be an analogy. Like so much of the sheep is analogous to the human person, and so much of it is analogous to Christ. But like the fact about how dumb they are, it's like totally us. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
He was explaining how when you kill a sheep, it's so important. It's the way you slaughter it is like one of the most important things, and you want to kill any animal when it's very calm, because otherwise it gets excited, has this adrenaline rush, and all this lactic acid gets released, and some of the meat just doesn't taste right. And so he was explaining how with a sheep, if you can control its body, you control its mind. And so if you can simply stop it from running around, because they don't actually freak out because you're there, they freak out because they have this reaction where they start running. Mm-hmm. And they find themselves running and running and running. And then they're like, that's when they start to freak out because, hey, I'm running. You know, I must be in danger. Mm-hmm. And so if you can control their body, you can control their mind. And I think that the same thing is true for us when we pray. You know, like when we control our bodies, it has a way of controlling our minds.
Yeah.
I know that that's true for children. You know, like they say when you're disciplining your children, you should stand up. Because just the physical act of them having to look up at you mm-hmm. changes like their brain waves and makes them they have a different reaction. Whereas if you're on a like eye to eye with them mm-hmm. when they're being disciplined, I mean, it's just stuff like that, you know, just controlling the body controls the mind.
Yeah. And you're kind of tying all this back to liturgy, you know, Elquin, we talked about the, he had these various reforms that he was responsible for, cultural and educational reforms. But he's also, even prior to his cultural and educational reforms.
You're talking
reforms,
about Blessed Alcuin
correct,
of York.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, not the Alcuin Institute.
Correct.
But the man whom.
But nonetheless, we're mirroring.
Yes,
we're trying
yes,
to mirror everything
the man
that he did.
For whom you are named.
Correct.
Yes.
But even prior to his cultural and educational reforms was liturgical reforms. So he understood that if he was responsible for changing the culture, he had to change the cult. Right? Culture
nice.
Flows downstream from cult, from mm-hmm. worship. Yeah, so that is absolutely essential. If we are really trying to have a reform of Christian culture, it has to begin with the liturgy.
What
so
period?
Being lackadaisical in liturgy, being lackadaisical in even prayer life would stem from a bad would make a bad culture,
mm-hmm.
even in the home.
Correct. Yeah.
One of the things that Dr. Tim Gray says in his commentary on Exodus, the book of Exodus, is that liberation can only come through liturgy.
Beautiful.
Yeah, he's giving commentary on the Israelites
mm-hmm.
and the plagues themselves and what they're meant to be. And it's I find that to be true. Liberation can only come through liturgy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of like brings us back to a comment that we made earlier about peace and how the Romans allowed the people to retain their religion. I think that that alone, that was maybe like the wisest decision that they made as far as maintaining peace.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they had not done that, rebellion would have been rampant.
Mm-hmm.
You think about any governing body. If they allow you to worship and live your life in accordance with the way that you worship, but they're oppressive in other ways, man will still be happy, I think.
Yeah,
I know that if a government allowed me to be fully Catholic, but oppressed me in ways that were ancillary, I would be happy. I believe. The thing about that is that being Catholic it encompasses everything.
That's what I'm gonna say.
Exactly.
Yeah. So
you're just triple stamping a double stamp. You're just saying like
I was trying to.
As
think,
long as they let me do everything, I'd be great.
Right. It's like what would those ancillary oppressions be? I'm not sure.
Well, what's really
maybe if they said like everyone must have black hair. It's like all right, man, whatever. Yeah. It's like well, I'll have black hair or whatever.
Yeah. But what if the state requires you to renounce certain elements of your faith?
Yeah, see, then that's when I, like, stock up on ammo.
Yeah. It's interesting that, you know, if it's true that the incarnation occurred at the particular time that it did in the fullness of time, when you had this unique mixing of Jewish biblical faith, Roman peace and the incarnate in Greek philosophy, and that principally the order of the Roman Imperium allowed for these Jewish faith and the exercise of the human intellect to actually occur. Then you look back and you apply that then today, which is kind of an interesting kind of speculative exercise. but we see how the lack of civil order is really demonic because it prevents principally the exercising of our intellect, the exercise of virtue, which prevents contemplation.
Yeah. I do like it. Okay, so the three stools were Roman order, Greek thought. What was the third?
Biblical
faith. Oh,
yeah. Okay, so they're just faith. The Jewish.
Mm-hmm. Okay, right.
Faith. Okay. Juan, did we cover everything that you wanted us to cover?
Maybe
is a good enough answer for
now
me.
Now is the time.
Maybe we'll have a part two. Maybe we'll have a part two sometime.
No, speak now or forever hold your peace.
Or will the part two
include Borscht?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
You like
I'm
Borscht?
Game then. I do, yeah, especially
you know,
wands.
You know, I'm Polish.
Do you make Borscht?
I have one.
So yes.
Finding someone on an online Catholic dating site shouldn't be like shopping for a blender. So why do most dating sites leave you feeling like you're shopping for a spouse? At Catholic Singles, we connect members through our unique user polls and activities, which help you discover other members and their personalities and interests. Because you're a person, not a profile picture. So stop shopping and start discerning. Trust your love story to the original Catholic dating site and use the promo code BREADBOX at checkout for 20% off at CatholicSingles.com.